want the Republicans to wake up is the Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to do it live.
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Thanks for downloading the latest episode of the Peter B. Collins podcast. We have weathered some glitches at the website, and I think it's all stabilized and under control now. We'll be working on our feeds to iTunes in the next few days and hope to have all that squared away for you. I want to thank two people who have signed up for annual subscriptions to the Peter B. Collins Show, Tim McCarthy in Chicago and Mark the Boat Builder in Australia. I really appreciate your support, and it's encouraging me to keep going and feed you more podcasts as much as I possibly can. Here come two powerful voices fighting for civil liberties in the United States. First, attorney Carl Mayer, suing Obama over the National Defense Authorization Act. And then investigative reporter Jason Leopold tells us about the FBI's secret practice of blackballing requests of Freedom of Information Act files. That's all ahead on today's podcast. Thanks for listening. Journalist Chris Hedges is suing Barack Obama to assert our constitutional rights in the face of the NDAA. The cities have turned into jungles, and corruption is strangling the land. The police force is watching the people, and the people just can't understand. We don't know how to mind our own business, cause the whole world's got to be just like us. That's prophetic music from back in the Nixon era. It's John Kay and Steppenwolf. The song is called Monster. The police force is watching the people, he says, and the people just don't understand. And he talks about the endless wars. And this was done, this song was released in 1969 or 1970. And it has a great deal of meaning in context today because of the serious rollback in our constitutional rights that started with 9/11 and the Patriot Act, includes the authorization for the use of military force that was rushed through the Congress in that same fearful time period. And now many of the extra-legal policies that were launched under the Bush administration that expanded presidential power and decreased our constitutional protections have been enshrined in a new law. The National Defense Authorization Act is nominally just a defense funding bill, the annual Pentagon budget. But attached to it are clauses that cause us grave concern, and in particular, the part of it called the Homeland Battlefield Bill, which includes Section 1031. As I mentioned, Chris Hedges, a journalist who I have great admiration for and who's been on this program many times, he was the New York Times Middle East correspondent and bureau chief for many years. And he also has been a stout supporter of, and I think in some ways the intellectual engine for much of the Occupy movement in the past year. At truthdig.com, Chris Hedges routinely offers sharp criticism of President Obama on these issues. And I have to say, I haven't found much of Chris's writing that I disagree with. He has filed a lawsuit And the defendants are the President of the United States, Barack Obama, and the Secretary of Defense, Leon Panetta. His attorney, who also is my attorney, Carl J. Mayer, joins us from New Jersey today. Hello, Carl.
Hello, Peter. How are you?
I'm doing well, and it's always great to talk with you. You continue to represent me in a class action suit against the illegal wiretapping that was launched domestically by the Bush administration and continues under the Obama administration. Before we dive into the Hedges case, what's the status of the wiretapping cases that you have been shepherding?
Sure. Well, first, it's an honor, Peter, to represent people like yourself and Chris Hedges, people who stand up for the most basic and fundamental American liberties are rare and courageous in this country, and it's an honor to be able to do some work on their behalf. The status of the warrantless wiretapping case is that just recently, a couple of weeks ago, we secured a partial victory in the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, which is actually headquartered in San Francisco, though the argument took place in Seattle, Washington. The lower district court, one of the last acts of Judge Vaughn Walker, who's actually been courageous on some civil liberties things,
yes,
was to dismiss the warrantless wiretapping cases, which is, as you recall, we brought them against the major phone companies and the NSA and the Bush and Obama administrations for monitoring the phone calls of Americans domestically. So Judge Walker had dismissed those cases, but the Ninth Circuit recently reversed in part and allowed the case against the government to proceed so that we can now get discovery and hopefully go to trial to not just expose what the government has been doing, but stop it. And we think that was a big step. We'll probably wind up appealing the case against the phone companies to the Supreme Court. But at least there was some partial justice handed down from the Ninth Circuit. So we're glad about that.
And likewise, I praise Judge Walker. Not every decision he's made is something I fully agree with, but he courageously ruled for same-sex marriage in the Proposition 8 case here in California. And in the one of the wiretapping cases that did proceed in his court, the Al Haramain charity case, John Eisenberg, the appellate attorney, has been on our program many times and described the Kafka-esque routines that they went through. But Judge Walker, to his credit, wrote a ruling, a decision, that upheld that the plaintiffs were wiretapped and were able to prove it without using secret materials. And it appears, based on Eisenberg's characterization, that Judge Walker wrote his decision to be reviewed by Justice Kennedy. And, of course, he remains the swing vote on the sharply divided Supreme Court. And so as it works its way up through the courts, it'll be very interesting to see how that plays out. Well, Carl, to the issue before us, the National Defense Authorization Act and your lawsuit on behalf of Chris Hedges, I wanted to begin with a comment from Colleen Rowley. She was the FBI legal advisor in Minneapolis who tried to get the attention of FBI HQ in the weeks before 9/11 about the curious case of Zacharias Moussaoui, the alleged 20th hijacker, who was trying to attend a flight school in Minneapolis and had drawn quite a bit of attention. Rowley left the FBI after 20-plus years in 2005, and she remains a sharp critic of constitutional incursions in this country. And here's a comment that she gave us in a recent Boiling Frogs interview with Sybil Edmonds.
You know, the thing that's worse in some respects, and actually more surprising, that more American citizens now are not upset, is that every bad thing that's happened, everything that's well known now about Guantanamo, the fact that there was no evidence for hundreds of these detainees, the fact that they were tortured, all of those things are well known about Guantanamo. Well, we just passed a law that extends Guantanamo to American citizens. And you would think that that would get a little bit of a rise out of American citizens. And when Obama signed it on New Year's Eve, you would think that some of his base that are so busy now trying to get him reelected, you would think some of them would at least use their power, you know, to say this is wrong. You know, we got to rescind it. I, of course, am on all kinds of different lists and everything, and I don't see that. I will say one thing, though. I think that besides another big factor is simply that American citizenry is still very much asleep. I still don't think the majority of Americans, if you even ask, what do you think about the NDAA? I don't think you probably get 70% who even have any idea what it is or what happened.
And Carl Mayer, I think her 70% is even generous. What level of understanding do you think the average American has of the draconian language in the NDAA?
Well, I don't think ordinary Americans have a great familiarity with the intricacies of what emanates from Congress, but that's, I don't think it's entirely because they're asleep. I think it's more like they're disgusted with Congress. Congress is at an all-time low in approval ratings. I think 12% of the country approves of the job that Congress is doing.
I think it dropped into single digits. I think it's at 9%.
The 9%. I'm sorry, Peter. I'm behind the curve. I've overrated the scoundrels.
Yes.
But the general public, I think there's a belief amongst ordinary Americans that what comes out of Congress is largely largely bought and paid for by the corporate interests, and to the extent it has to do with foreign policy, it's a lot of posturing that has to do with elections or with the permanent military-industrial complex. So I wouldn't expect them to have a real familiarity, but I think that there are a substantial number of Americans who understand that more and more our civil liberties are being abrogated and pared back in the last decade, and it's all part of a pattern. The government is not only monitoring the phone calls of Americans in this country, which would have been inconceivable even back in Richard Nixon's era, that there was an enormous outcry against that. And there the outcry was led by members of Congress. So the American people no longer expect Congress to stand up for them. I think they have a general disapproval and distaste for what's occurring in the country. There were some preliminary online polls which showed that support for the Homeland Battlefield Act was running in the single digits as well, between 2% and 9%. So the people who are polled about this are opposed to it. It doesn't matter whether they're independent, Democratic, or Republican. There's enormous opposition to this. I think people are uncertain how to present their opposition. I'm fortunate that I can play a role as a lawyer to help litigate and bring opposition to bear that way.
Mm-hmm.
But I think people, even if they don't understand the fine print, they have a gut understanding that their civil liberties are being not so gradually stripped away from them.
Yeah. And Carl, I do these interviews with Sybil Edmonds, who is a courageous woman who blew the whistle on wrongdoing at the FBI, got fired, was subject to state secrets gag orders as a result. And she was born in Turkey. She lived in revolutionary Iran and came to the United States in the 1980s. And like many people who were not born here who are citizens, she has a pretty literal interpretation of the Constitution and of the oath of office. And it's important to underscore that our elected officials take an oath to defend the Constitution, not to protect us from foreign enemies, but to protect the Constitution, and that they are clearly failing in the execution of that solemn oath. And secondly, Sybil points out that we have lost our constitutional rights, not to an enemy, not because Al-Qaeda did it or the Taliban or, you know, Saddam Hussein. We have done it to ourselves.
Right. Yes, to some degree. I guess it is fair to say that if more Americans took to the streets and exercised their political power, they could do something about this. But I don't think it's possible they will. I think the Occupy Wall Street movement of the last year has shown there's a greater willingness on the part of Americans of all ages to start to fight back against both government and corporate abuses of power and intrusions on the privacy and the rights of the citizens. But you raised a good point about the importance of the Constitution. The Constitution is the most important document in American government because it was written to make sure that never again in this country were the tyrannies that the British visited upon the American population at the time of the Revolution, that never again would those tyrannies be allowed to exist in this country. And I think a lot of people, like the woman you just mentioned, who come from abroad, come to America not just because it's a place where you have an opportunity to make money, but because it's a place that upholds the rule of law and civil liberty.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why it's so anti-American and anti-rule of law for the president to sign the bill that he did on December 31st, the Homeland Battlefield Act. I actually think this is the most cynical act of the Obama presidency, because the president is in fact a constitutional law scholar.
Yeah.
He knows better.
Mm-hmm.
He knows. He said himself in the signing statement that he attached to the bill that he had serious reservations about the bill. And then he went on to further say that under his administration there would be no detentions in military prisons of American citizens. Well, he knows is a constitutional law statement that the statement of one president doesn't mean anything. It's that we're a nation of laws, not of men. So he could be replaced as president as early as next January 2013. And this law, which is unconstitutional, I think, by any measure, will still be on the books. So unless we defeat it in the courts, what you will have is a law on the books that overturns 200 years of American tradition and law, which prohibits domestic policing. What this law essentially allows is domestic policing by the military. And essentially what we're saying in this lawsuit is that it's written so broadly that it could this law would permit the arrest and detention in a military prison indefinitely until the end of hostilities, however that's defined.
Right.
Or it could permit the trial of a U.S. citizen or permanent resident in a military court rather than a civilian court, or it allows the rendition of those persons to a prison overseas or to a foreign country in an undisclosed facility. All of these things should be frightening to every American that cares about their liberties and cares about this country, because the language of the law is so broad. It doesn't say that this law applies to somebody who has committed a terrorist act on American soil or has committed an act of violence. All it says is that a person can be detained indefinitely or placed in a military tribunal if they gave, quote, substantial support for Al-Qaeda or other quote, associated forces. So mm-hmm. It's completely nebulous.
Well, and here's broad language in Section 1031, B1. A covered person, by the way, under this section, is any person as follows. A person who planned, authorized, committed, or aided the terrorist attacks that occurred on September 11 or harbored those responsible for those attacks, or Section 2, a person who was part of or substantially supported Al-Qaeda, the Taliban, or associated forces that are engaged in hostilities against the United States or its coalition partners, including any person who has committed a belligerent act or who has directly supported such hostilities in aid of such enemy forces. Now, this is incredibly vague. For example, the Taliban is an amorphous term that, depending on who you're talking about and who you're talking to, can represent very different groups. The Taliban was started by the Pakistani ISI, their equivalent of the CIA. And there is an Afghan Taliban that is not exactly the same as the Pakistani Taliban. And without correct definitions, this is so broad that anybody who went to Afghanistan and ended up having dinner with somebody in an inn or a restaurant who happens to be a member of something called the Taliban could be indicted and or actually just captured and held without being charged, without being tried indefinitely.
Right. Well put, Peter. And that's also why Chris Hedges is the perfect plaintiff for this litigation, because he has been a journalist who's covered the Middle East for 20 years with as a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter for the New York Times. He interviewed Yasser Arafat. He interviewed members of all of these organizations, Al-Qaeda, the Taliban. And who's to say, under this law, that Chris Hedges and journalists like him are not, as the law says, quote, substantially supporting terrorist organizations simply by giving them an interview and airing their views, or, in Chris's case, offering their opinions as to how the populations of some of these countries relate to these terrorist organizations. So all of this means that it would have a chilling effect on the journalistic free expression of free speech, which is a basic and fundamental right that the First Amendment secures. It also means that these provisions that you quoted under the Homeland Battlefield Act are unconstitutional because they don't provide due process to Americans under the Fifth Amendment. All of us have a right to trial by jury. That means a right to trial by our peers in an open court of law, guaranteed by the Fifth Amendment, and this bill takes that away. And it really is an outrageous attempt to circumvent the Constitution, even to the point where during the American Civil War, when there was an enormous threat to the nation, there was an opinion that came down called Ex Parte Milligan, which the Supreme Court delivered after the arrest by the military of a man named Milligan, who was a Confederate sympathizer who overtly planned to overthrow the governments of Indiana, Ohio, and Michigan. And Milligan was ordered sentenced to death by a military tribunal. The Supreme Court reversed that and sent it back down and said, no, even when there is such a grave danger to the Republic, the citizens of this nation have the right to a trial by jury. They have a right to due process and Fifth Amendment guarantees under the Constitution. And if the law could allow for the civil courts to operate during the Civil War, when there was an enormous threat to the nation, today, even Obama's own Defense Department admits that the Taliban and Al-Qaeda are broken organizations. They don't pose a threat to the nation. They're now leaderless. And so there's no reason to put on the books this draconian legislation, which is just tremendously overbroad. And so it's very disappointing that the president chose to do this, because now, at the end of the day, he is essentially on this issue running to the right of the likes of Rick Santorum, Rush Limbaugh, and Ron Paul, who have all come out against the Homeland Battlefield Bill because it's an abrogation of civil liberties. One of the few serious moments during these Republican debates was this past weekend,
mm-hmm.
when there was a question posed about the Homeland Battlefield Act, and Romney, of course, came out and supported it.
He's the guy who last time in 08 said he wanted to double Gitmo.
He wanted to double down on Gitmo.
That was his low IQ bumper sticker response.
Right.
And Ron Paul, has been very good on these issues. And I was floored when Rick Santorum said that he opposed the NDAA. I also was kind of floored that Fox News even brought it up because it did present an opportunity for them to compliment President Obama for his extrajudicial killing of Osama bin Laden. And I want to take a moment here because I have been quite exercised about the execution by drone of Anwar al-Awlaki, an American citizen who did speak out against the United States, and he is on videotape encouraging jihad. But we've seen absolutely no evidence that he did conspire with either Abdul Muttalib, the so-called Detroit underwear bomber, or the people in Yemen who tried to send explosive ink cartridges to a Jewish site in Chicago. These are all unproven allegations that have been floated in the media, but we didn't even attempt to build a case against al-Awlaki. We simply demonized him. The Center for Constitutional Rights tried to bring a case on behalf of his father, and that was flushed out of the courts. And then the Obama team just offed this guy. And in the following week, additional drone strikes killed his two teenage sons. And I have serious problems with this. And I almost ruined the Christmas dinner because my brother looked at me and said, "I don't have any problem with that. They're ragheads."
Yeah.
And I said, "Well, wait a minute. What they wear on their heads doesn't matter. They happen to be American citizens."
Yeah.
So tell me your thoughts about that and how this new NDAA would permit a replication of the al-Awlaki execution.
Well, conceivably could, by allowing for the rendition of U.S. citizens and permanent residents overseas. And because the purpose of that, of course, is that once these people are sent overseas, there are often no constitutional or civil rights protections. They can be put in gulags, waterboarded, assassinated, and that's the downside of the globalization of the war on terror is that, and it's a particularly cynical move as well to effectively take U.S. residents and citizens out of the country and out of the protection of American laws to send them overseas, where the government can then try to seek the lowest common denominator to find countries where there are the least protections for these people. Because, look, it's possible that people who were caught up in the net of the NDAA would be terrorists, but they could also be legitimate journalists. So everyone is entitled to their day in court.
Well, there is also the active investigation, and Michael Deutsch is an attorney with the People's Law Office in Chicago, who represents individuals in Chicago and Minneapolis whose homes were raided by the FBI in September of 2010. This was clearly approved by the very top officials in the Obama Justice Department. And while these people have not been charged or tried, they basically were roughed up and got the full Patriot Act treatment because they had been proposing peace talks with factions in Colombia, the FARC, and also reaching out to some of the elements, I believe, in Palestine and in Afghanistan. And they're a pro-peace group. And how do you promote peace if you don't talk to people who are engaged in conflict? It's just bizarre that we would try to turn peace activists into terrorists and essentially use police state tactics to silence them and end their participation in these activities.
Yeah, it's all part of the growing net that's being cast around civil disobedience and free speech in this country, and it's really against all of our traditions. I think people have noticed, for example, that when the Occupy Wall Street protesters have been removed from public spaces around the country, the police doing the removing look like army paratroopers. They're in paramilitary garb, which wasn't the case for police 10 or 15 years ago.
Well, and we know that the crackdown on Occupy movements, this dumbass mayor of Oakland, Jean Kwan, blurted out that she'd been on a conference call with 18 other mayors. It was orchestrated by a group with ties to the Department of Homeland Security that coordinates the, you know, different police activities across the nation. The outlines are very clear of the militarization of police activities, particularly when it comes to protests and protected First Amendment activities.
Yeah, and unfortunately, there's more that's coming potentially. The Republicans in Congress have introduced a bill to strip Americans of their citizenship if they lend support by the definition of the bill to terrorist groups or organizations. The Expatriation Act, I think it was introduced by Congressman Dent from Pennsylvania. And that's another terrible development to, again, try to say or enshrine into law that people who are opposed to the government or opposed to particular views can be stripped of U.S. citizenship. These are terrible precedents and attempts at changing our country. Mm-hmm. And I hope that Americans won't take this lying down. And I fully expect in the spring that the Occupy Wall Street movement will spring back, and I don't know what form. But I also think that in conjunction with the Occupy forces, there'll be some more fights on these civil liberties issues. Because we've heard, after filing the lawsuit, we've heard from a number of Occupy Wall Street groups around the country, and they're as concerned about these breaches of civil liberties as they are about the corporate predations.
Now, Carl, I, on the face of it, don't support the Republican bill you just cited, but it is at least putting it out in broad daylight. Right now, we have these Republican presidential candidates sanctimoniously saying, in the case of Alaki, well, you know, if you, advocate against the United States, you lose your citizenship rights. Well, that's not true. That is fundamentally false. Yet they sanctimoniously offer these platitudes, and there are a lot of people who just nod their heads. That's right. That's right. You oppose this country, then we can take you out.
Right. Right. It harkens back to what was Nixon's phrase: "America, love it or leave it." Right.
Well,
that's exactly the opposite view from that held by the founders of the nation, the framers of the Constitution. Their point in drafting the Constitution is you have to allow vigorous and open dissent, because that's precisely what's not permitted under tyrannies like the British Empire.
Mm-hmm. Now, Carl, in this suit, you lay out five different counts related to constitutional violations that you find in the National Defense Authorization Act and the Homeland Battlefield portion of it. Give us a sketch here for people like me who follow the law but never studied the law. This is prospective in nature, because Chris Hedges has not been detained in an unconstitutional manner, and you are attempting to establish violations of constitutional rights to prevent them from occurring. I understand that. But how does this work legally? can't they dismiss this by saying you don't have a cause of action because you can't prove that any actual violation has yet occurred?
Right. Well, there's no question that one of the government's arguments will be that that the suit is premature and that journalist Hedges doesn't have standing. But we believe that the law is sufficiently broad, and Hedges' activities and statements discussing terrorist organizations are sufficiently well documented that that he has standing because he believes there is it's plausible, and that usually is the standard for standing and getting by a motion to dismiss in federal court, that it's plausible that he would be swept up in the net of this law. And what we're seeking to do is have the statute declared as unconstitutional to begin with. We may even, and I'll update you on this, Peter, the law is not scheduled to take effect until March 12th of
right.
this year.
Mm-hmm.
We may even go in for an injunction to prevent the law from being put into effect until these constitutional issues can be sorted out by the courts.
Mm-hmm.
And our fundamental thrust in the litigation is that there are three branches of government. There's the executive branch, there's the legislative branch, Congress, and there's the judiciary. And what this bill is trying to do is trying essentially to intrude on the powers, the independent powers of the judiciary, by taking American citizens outside of the judicial process and putting them into military courts and military tribunals.
Right.
That's our fundamental thrust. The various counts, however, state that essentially each one of these sections violates the Fifth Amendment Due Process Clause because the Fifth Amendment guarantees due process in several respects. You should have the right to confront your accuser and the right to a trial by jury as guaranteed by the Fifth Amendment, and this bill doesn't allow that. You also have the right to speak freely if you're a journalist like Chris Hedges or yourself. It's very chilling to have a bill like this pass, which could result in the detention of journalists or opinion makers who express, quote, substantial support for, quote, associated forces. So that's the thrust of our litigation. And I just think it's way too overbroad to be constitutional.
And well, I certainly agree with you, and it'll be interesting to see how judges rule, because the courts are packed with pro-administration, pro-executive authority figures who have been placed on the court over the last 20 years or so. So that part will be very interesting to see. If you can get traction with some individual judges at the start, and then at the appellate level, we'll see how it plays out there as well. Carl, as we wrap up here, I want to return to a powerful comment that you made earlier, and that is that you said this is the most cynical move by President Obama and his administration. And I agree with that, and I want to underscore it, because not only is the president's signing statement ineffective and it doesn't move me in any way because he's a guy who said he wouldn't use signing statements, and then he signed this bill and said, but I don't like it and I won't use those powers. But it was cynical from the beginning. We know from Senator Carl Levin, who explicitly stated on the Senate floor that the White House told him to remove the language that would clearly have excluded American residents and citizens in the United States from the language of this bill. And number one, it's a shame and tragic that Carl Levin agreed to the order from the White House. But we also need to clarify for people, because there was at one point a threat of a veto from the White House, but it wasn't over the language that you're challenging. It was over the language that ties the president's hands and requires that, actual suspects picked up in other countries must be handled by the military and go through tribunals. There's very little option to take them through our criminal courts. And so the subterfuge that was used and the kind of, double blinks that we saw from those in the administration and some on Capitol Hill is breathtaking, because this was the American people, there was a major attempt to play us on this, and I think it succeeded to some extent.
Yeah, it was cynical in several different ways, and for the president who campaigned on the mantra of hope, the audacity of hope, this is the opposite of hope. This is cynicism of the worst sort, and that's why I think there are a lot of the young people in the country who spent hundreds of hours for Obama are not going to come out this time, and I hope those young people will direct themselves to the Occupy Wall Street protests and associated protests to turn back these fundamental assaults on all of our rights.
Well, Carl, thanks for all you do in this arena, and in particular, I'm very pleased that you and Chris Hedges, and let's give credit to Bruce Afran, who is your co-counsel on this case. I'm pleased that you've brought it, and we'll support you every step of the way.
Great. Thank you very much, Peter. Keep on keeping on.
Carl Mayer here on the Peter B. Collins Show. We continue on the Peter B. Collins Show, fighting for your constitutional rights and taking on the creeping police state in this country. Here's a song that goes back to the J. Edgar Hoover era about going downtown and working for the FBI. Remember this? The FBI is one of many federal agencies subject to the Freedom of Information Act. The FOIA was put into effect following the misdeeds of the Watergate era and COINTELPRO over at the FBI. And on paper, it says that a citizen has the right to request from government agencies, law enforcement agencies like the FBI, records of anything that they may have about that individual. And a little bit later, I'll tell you about my own effort to secure information that might have been in an FBI file under a FOIA request. It goes back a few years. But Jason Leopold, the intrepid investigative reporter and deputy managing editor at truthout.org, returns to our program today because he has revealed in an important article published on January 17 a few holes in the practices of the response to FOIA requests over at the Federal Bureau of Investigation. Jason, always a pleasure to talk with you.
Hey, Peter. Happy New Year, and great to be back with you.
Well, thanks for digging in on this, because, of course, you know that we are being led by the most transparent administration in American history.
I laugh, because that's certainly what they like to put out there, but it's far from the truth.
Now, wait a minute. President Obama secretly received an award for transparency last year.
Yes. It's hilarious.
And you know, we did cover that on the program, and Sybil Edmonds launched a petition campaign to get the organizations that gave those awards to rescind them, or at least to acknowledge how empty they are. But what you've discovered here is really important.
Yeah, this is incredibly fascinating. And, you know, for the past year, I personally have utilized the Freedom of Information Act, certainly with the FBI and other government agencies. I've probably filed about between 70 and 100 requests for documents. And this particular story and this revelation here really calls into question, obviously, the government's efforts to, conceal documents, to be transparent. It's a process known as blackballing. And that's blackballing and blackball is the FBI's own term for how certain files, not requests, they say, but how certain files are handled.
Mm-hmm.
And this story came to me which I didn't disclose in the article, but just a quick little background. I received the information on this story after I had published a report last year when I filed a Freedom of Information Act with the FBI and Department of Homeland Security seeking, under the Freedom, under the Freedom of Information Act, seeking documents related to Occupy Wall Street.
Okay.
And the response I received from the FBI was that they did not have a single document related to Occupy Wall Street, which was laughable, Peter, because I had already found such documents online. So a person named Trevor Griffey, a labor historian, reached out to me after seeing that story and said that there's something bigger taking place here.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know that when you file a Freedom of Information Act, that the government, the FBI, may blackball certain files? So, for example, Peter, let's say you wanted to file a Freedom of Information Act on me,
mm-hmm.
and you know, you want to find out, you know, what's out there. The government will, you know, do a search. And let's say there's a file that comes up, and for one reason or another, which we don't know, they decide to blackball that file. The response you will get, Peter, is we did not locate any files, records responsive to your request. So the FBI will not tell you that they already found a file. And perhaps it may be a date that's wrong. You know, perhaps you forgot to do something. We don't know. But they won't tell you that they had found a file. They won't tell you why it was blackballed. They won't even say that it was blackballed. They'll simply say, we can't locate anything. And unless you're a savvy user, if you will, of the Freedom of Information Act, and you request the FBI's own processing notes. And that's very important. And anyone, you know, listening to the program who does use FOIA should always utilize that. And processing notes basically will give you this sort of what takes place, you know, give you insight to what takes place behind the scenes when you're filing a FOIA request. This basically provides you with all the traffic, the email traffic going back and forth. It's sort of like being a fly on the wall, if you will, while this is taking place.
And let me be clear, these processing notes occur anytime there is a FOIA request, but unless you explicitly ask for processing notes, they don't feel compelled to serve up that information.
Oh, absolutely not. So it's the only, and most people just have no idea that they can do that. So unless you ask for processing notes, you won't know that a file has been blackballed.
Mm-hmm.
But what's really disturbing is that there are certain files that are automatically blackballed. And Trevor Griffey, a professor teaches U.S. history at Evergreen State University, he had been working on a civil rights project related to civil rights movement,
mm-hmm.
in Washington. And he had requested some documents to see if Manning Marable, who's a professor at Columbia University, passed away last year. He just wrote a book on Malcolm X. He wanted to find out if he had ever filed a FOIA request seeking, you know, documents on Malcolm X. And
we know there were plenty of those.
Plenty of those, yes. And, you know, as I said, Marable had been working on this biography. So the FBI sent him a letter saying they have no record, no records responsive to your request. And he found that odd, that, well, this doesn't make sense. He's writing this biography. How could there not be any, you know, any, how could he have not requested those documents? So he emailed a FBI FOIA analyst, and they exchanged some emails. And it does appear that it was a mistake or a slip, but the analyst said could not find anything. The only thing that came up was one file, and that was, quote, blackballed.
Mm-hmm.
And immediately he became concerned, and he said, "See, that's what I thought." He did request documents, but you're just not telling me or other people who may be seeking documents under FOIA that you found anything. So he filed a Freedom of Information Act for the standard operating procedure for excluding files or blackballing files under FOIA.
Now, let's take a moment here because I find this term fascinating.
It is fascinating, yes.
In my experience, the term blackball comes from private clubs where someone applies for membership. And current members say they don't want this person to join, but they don't put a name on their rejection. They simply blackball the individual, and then they leave it to a functionary to say, sorry, the committee did not approve your application. And the term blackball, I think, has been used in political circles as well. But to see this as an official term, you didn't invent blackball. You didn't use it as shorthand to describe what the FBI is doing. Their own damn files, and you know, your fellow Griffey here got a PowerPoint presentation that uses the term blackball. So this is official FBI policy using a murky verb, blackball, which certainly doesn't appear in the FOIA law that requires them to produce information
exactly
on request.
It does not. And in fact, the FBI spokesperson had told me that blackball is, quote, a term of art. It's an unfortunate term used by the FBI analysts. But this standard operating procedure, because I, you know, just to back up a bit, the FOIA analyst had told Griffey via email the file on Maribel was, quote, blackballed per our SOP, our standard operating procedure. So he filed a Freedom of Information Act request asking for that standard operating procedure.
Mm-hmm.
And they were actually quite, they responded rather quickly. Which I am not used to seeing for any FOIA request that I file, but they responded quickly and they turned over 5 pages. And it's an undated PowerPoint presentation that basically instructs FOIA analysts, you know, when to blackball, what files are blackballed. However, there is a redaction in this PowerPoint. It's very funny, Peter.
Yeah, that cracks me up.
It's truly, I hope people are following here. So, on one hand, it says, these are the types of files that would be ripe for blackballing. Classifications known as 190 main files. 190 is a classification pertaining to the Freedom of Information Act, Privacy Act. So, on individuals, okay? Then the other classification is 197. That pertains to civil litigation. Then there is an entirely separate file, okay, or separate classification that we don't even know what it is. They redacted it in the PowerPoint. And they told Griffey in basically the exemption that they cited is that, you know, the release of this information would, you know, could damage, you know, ongoing investigations or prosecutions, and that's why it's redacted. So we have
Hold on. We're supposed to believe that this is being withheld because the investigation of Malcolm X is still ongoing?
Well, that's this is actually the reason that they withheld or redacted it from the PowerPoint.
All right,
let me thing at this point. I know it's a bit technical and confusing here.
But let me read the clause 7E from your article.
Yeah.
They can withhold it if it would disclose techniques and procedures for law enforcement investigations or prosecutions, or would disclose guidelines for law enforcement investigations or prosecutions if such disclosure could reasonably be expected to risk circumvention of the law.
Right. And he appealed that. And they denied his appeal. So to this day, we don't know, you know, exactly what the other classification of files are that are ripe for blackballing. We have no idea. And I also want to point out here that the blackballing in and of itself, this has never been revealed before. It's a very, very important revelation, certainly as people file more and more Freedom of Information Act requests. It's a very important revelation, never has been disclosed before. And in fact, I spoke to many, many experts, open government experts, who had never even heard of the term.
Mm-hmm.
There was one person, one open government expert that I spoke with, who had heard of blackballing and discovered it when he actually sought the FBI's processing notes. And in those processing notes that he received, he saw the term blackball being used, contacted the FBI, and spokesperson more or less explained what it is. But this PowerPoint is important. And I do believe that ultimately this should arm people with important information. As I said, it now people can now find out, you know, if they choose to, you know, to request those processing notes to find out if they ever receive a no records response request, which, by the way, Peter, was the same response that I received when I had filed for the documents on Occupy Wall Street, mm-hmm. simply to see if the FBI, you know, was playing any role. Now, I suspect that perhaps that no records response may be due to the fact that there's an ongoing investigation.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah.
Because they did, I do know that they have the documents. And I should add that I have since received a letter from the FBI saying, by the way, we actually do have some documents. We made a mistake. We do have some documents on Occupy Wall Street, and we're reprocessing your request. So, you know, this is just amazing. It's truly amazing. And, you know, you brought up the whole issue about transparency, particularly as it pertains to this administration. You know, this administration is far from transparent. This administration is arguably, in some respects, worse than the Bush administration. And the reason I say that is if you look at the Bush administration, okay, if you look at what has been released over the years by the Bush administration, even though John Ashcroft had, you know, put in place this sort of edict that would allow FOIA to be circumvented by certain agencies. If you look at it as it certainly pertains to, you know, to counterterrorism, torture, Guantanamo, there have been, you know, hundreds of thousands of documents that have been released. Certainly the ACLU can attest to that. But this administration has actually, you know, gone to the Supreme Court to, excuse me, to try and block the release of photographs related to the treatment of prisoners in Iraq and Afghanistan. They worked with Congress to tweak FOIA in such a way that it would allow the Secretary of Defense to withhold those types of images from being released under FOIA, routinely invoking, you know, national security. Again, you know, Bush did the same thing, and I don't mean to more or less say, you know, Bush was any better, but there were documents that were released, and maybe we've just seen, you know, many of those come out of that administration.
Well, Jason, I would add, I agree with your assessment. I do think that Obama is actually worse than Bush, because Bush was pretty confrontational and would just say, you know, F you,
right.
You know, with a kind of Dick Cheney attitude. The Obama team is much more duplicitous and circuitous in the way they handle these things. And we discussed that with Carl Mayer in the preceding segment about the attack on the constitutionality of the recently signed National Defense Authorization Act,
right,
and the head fakes that were being used as Obama threatened to veto legislation, but not to protect American citizens, to protect his own expansion of executive authority. And so I do agree with you on that point, and it's quite troubling. One of the things that really jumped out at me in your article is from this PowerPoint about blackballing files. And it reads here that they can do this. Such files are blackballed unless specifically asked for by the requester when an initial FOIA request is made.
Right.
So does the law say that you have to get the specific search terms and keywords right on your first request, or you're shit out of luck? Or does it say that you may make repeated requests for the same material, particularly given the way they play games with how you ask for it?
Yeah, I mean, you could ask for the same material, but they'll handle it differently. In terms of the searches that they conduct, I can tell you that I filed an appeal with the FBI based on their initial response to me with Occupy Wall Street, simply because they conducted an incredibly narrow search. They're supposed to search. Certainly, there were some changes made to FOIA, when this administration came into office. And now, automatically, when you make a request to the FBI, all the field offices are searched as well. At least they're supposed to be. They're not supposed to just search what they call their central records database, mm-hmm, but they're also supposed to search field offices. However, the FBI is known to conduct as narrow search as possible. They're known to do that. Their searches are terrible. So I shouldn't say the responsibility, but the requester would best be served if he or she filed a FOIA request and said, I want to make sure you search the field offices. I want to make sure you use these search terms. In fact, to Griffey, the FOIA analyst, when she was responding to him via email, said, hey, maybe if you supply me with some more keyword searches.
Mm-hmm.
But what good would that have done when she had already indicated that they found a file? When it was blackballed.
Yeah.
And again, I want to emphasize, nobody knows why that file was blackballed. He asked for a file. No idea why they decided to blackball. And again, it could be something rather simple. It could be maybe he got a date wrong. Maybe the FBI tried to explain that it could just be that we found a file for Peter Collins. But Peter B. Collins, but it was a different Peter B. Collins.
Mm-hmm.
And so we blackballed it.
Well,
that would be a good explanation, right, Peter? But wouldn't it help you, the requester, if you knew that?
Well, let me tell you my own story now. And since you're, a 70 FOIA veteran of this process, maybe you can help me out. From 1973 to 76, I hosted a talk show in Chicago. And during that time, I gave heavy coverage to the Fred Hampton trial. Fred was dead. He'd been killed by the FBI in a police raid. Actually, Chicago police killed him, but it was a raid that was coordinated and based on an FBI infiltrator. And there were weird things that happened. And I'll just tell one story. I would get, on a monthly basis, a package from somebody who appeared to be a listener, who listened to every minute of my show, 4 hours a night between 1 and 5 in the morning, 5 nights a week. And he would create little mini magazines, and he would cut out pictures from creepy horror movie pulp magazines and write new captions to them that were based on actual quotations from things that happened on my radio show. Now, it was amusing at first, but the last 3 issues of this handmade magazine were delivered to the windshield of my car parked in front of my apartment. And I believe that this was an effort to chill me, to tell me to shut up and talk about something besides the FBI and COINTELPRO. And so it took me a few years, but in the 80s, I filed a FOIA request, and I was very nervous about it because I felt that by asking for it, I was drawing attention to myself in ways that might cause them to look at me when they never had before. At any rate, after about a six-month delay, there was a response, and I did ask that they check the Chicago Bureau and the Central Files, but I wasn't really savvy enough about the process to maybe ask for the right terms. And so it's still an open question to me whether those bizarre packages that I received had some relation to COINTELPRO and the FBI's counterintelligence program. And I'm still curious about it today if you want to file your 74th FOIA request.
Sure. I mean, Peter, I can tell you that in my appeal, I mean, part of this is, you know, keep in mind that they're searching their central records database and the field offices. However, you know, you're going back to, you know, the 70s, the early 70s, perhaps not everything has been digitized.
Mm-hmm.
So you'd have to ask them to, you know, also look at the files that are not, and that their search should revolve around not just what's in the central records database, not what is just perhaps contained in field offices, but paper files,
mm-hmm.
their own paper files. And that's something that's also important that people need to understand, that kind of a search is not often conducted. And they sometimes will, you know, will have to ask for that. Because as I said again, you know, they conduct as narrow a search as possible, and not in the interest of finding documents. That sort of seems to be the, you know, the open secret.
Yeah. The other thing I'll add is that one of the attorneys who represented the survivors of Fred Hampton in what was ultimately a successful case against the government was able to FOIA during the 1980s as they continued that lengthy litigation. And there were misdeeds by the FBI even after the federal cases had been filed. And so what I'm really curious about, and my own case aside, is if the blackballing goes back to the origins of FOIA.
Yeah, actually a good question. And I have to tell you that it's unclear. You know, this PowerPoint is undated. It's unclear how far back it goes. But I will tell you, Peter, that since you, if you did not file a FOIA request, but did you say you filed a FOIA request? I'm sorry.
Yes, I did file one. Uh-huh.
You can actually file a FOIA request and ask for those processing notes.
Yeah. All right, I'm going to conspire with you on that, Jason, just even if it's just for fun, but it could reveal something interesting about just how far back the blackballing process goes and when it was actually instituted and under which FBI director.
Yeah, and you could learn as well as you know, what steps were taken, how they conducted the search.
Yeah. Well, Jason, before you go, is there anything else that you learned in this process that will sharpen your skills in future FOIA requests?
Yeah, I mean, I will seek any files. Anytime I receive a no records response, I mean, I'm certainly going to now ask for the processing notes and any files that were blackballed. Again, it pertains to individuals and civil litigation and then a category we don't know. I'm going to ask for those files. And I think that anyone who files a FOIA now and receives that no records response, no responsive records response, they would best be served by then following it up
mm-hmm.
for a request for the processing notes and anything that was blackballed.
All right. Well, Jason, this is a fascinating peeling back of the curtain on investigation and great work by you, an investigative reporter.
Thank you very much, Peter.
Jason Leopold, truthout.org. Hold on tight to your constitutional rights and your civil liberties. And send me an email, peter@peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to you. until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until